From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in October. That's when New York State began to mandate that all employers must adopt sexual harassment prevention policy and training. And in the era of Me Too, this is a significant change to the law. For a moment, think back to a workplace training in which you've had to participate. Did you find it helpful or tedious? Did you learn anything? Research indicates that most workplace training isn't effective. But why not? There's so many questions, and there's so many issues like sexual harassment that are important. Why do so many workers tend to snooze through these trainings? This hour, we're going to discuss what's coming our way with the changes in the law, and we'll also talk about how to make training better, more effective, and more engaging. The law now says that all workers have to be trained annually, including vendors or temporary workers of any kind. So wherever you work, or wherever you plan to work, get ready for more of it. The objective is to reduce harassment at work. Let's find out if the changes might actually accomplish that. I'd like to welcome my guest this hour. Sharon Stiller is a partner and director of the employment law practice at Abrams and Fensterman. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Allison Roberts is the co-founder and co-director of Impact Interactive, a theater-based training company. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Impact Interactive.
So Impact Interactive uses interactive theater techniques, drama techniques, and sometimes written scripted scenes to get participants thinking and feeling and delving a little deeper into whatever the topic is. It gets them engaged, up on their feet, moving around, and they're not sitting in front of a PowerPoint.
And we're going to talk a lot about that this hour. And Allison has brought a whole team with her. Also joining us in studio is Rick Starpoli. He's a performance educator with Impact Interactive. Welcome to you.
Thanks so much, Megan.
And Ashley Valdez-Garcelle is a business manager and performance educator for Impact Interactive. Welcome.
Thanks, Megan.
Also joining us, Cecilia Barone. She's the assistant director in the workshop program at the University of Rochester Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And before we get started, a quick message from our news director, Randy Gorman, as he joins us on this one-day pledge drive. Hi, Randy.
How are you, Megan? A good way to end the year, a positive way, really, because if you do support the kinds of programming, and I think a lot of people listening to this show know how great Connections has been all year long, and not just because of its host, but its producer, who was filling in today, Megan Mack. They work together as a team and put some really, really interesting and insightful programming on a lot of issues that have to do with the things that we are dealing with in the Rochester community and across the country, across the world, really, all year long. Please show your support right now. We have our volunteers standing by to take your calls. If you want to do this by telephone, any amount that you can pledge would be great. 454-6300. That's 454-6300. It's toll-free, 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or you can just do it online, wxxinews.org. But please do that soon, because obviously it's the kind of thing you tend to forget if you're not doing it right away, because we have such busy lives we're dealing with. A lot of folks are off this week, so maybe you have a bit more time. But again, anything you can do to help continue the kind of programming that we like to bring to you every day would be very helpful. And of course, if you are concerned about taxes, which are coming up before you know it, it is a tax-deductible contribution. 454-6300, and thank you for your support, Megan.
Thank you, Randy. And just to piggyback on what Randy said, Evan and I often talk about if we didn't have the opportunity to have these hour-long discussions every day, 2 hours every day on important topics like sexual harassment prevention and training, how would your conversations in your lives be different? What would your day be like if you didn't have Connections? So keep that in mind when you call 454-6300 or go online to wxxinews.org. So perhaps about everyone listening has had to sit through some kind of workplace training, some kind of sexual harassment training at some point, whether it's a lecture, a PowerPoint presentation, some kind of online quiz. Well, a 2016 study by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission stated that those trainings must change because many of them haven't worked. And Sharon, I know that you've read that study in full. You have a lot of opinions about it. But based on what the law now says, we want to keep our focus on the big picture, which is eliminating sexual harassment in the workplace. Why have many of these trainings been so ineffective?
So I think it's fascinating that the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, did this study in 2016. And basically what they said is that sexual harassment has been defined as being prohibited for 30 years. So why don't we have less of it? In fact, this past year, the sexual harassment claims filed with the EEOC increased by 12%. So we've been doing training for years and years and years. And what the EEOC did is an in-depth look and found that too many of the trainings simply focus on legal compliance. They don't really focus on the underlying issues, which largely can be framed in terms of respect. Why is it that people discriminate against other people? Why do they use harassing language? What is the power interplay? And so the EEOC recommended, among other things, that we change the way we deliver training so that it's more effective. But that also has to be part of a much bigger picture.
And it, so much of it may feel like checking a box for HR departments or even people sitting through these trainings. And I'll turn to the rest of you on the panel now. I'm sure you've taken some of these trainings in your lives. Allison, does it feel, before you got involved with Impact Interactive, did it feel like checking a box for you? Or were you able to immerse yourself in it in depth? How did that feel?
Well, depending on, you know, where I was working, it varied. But there is definitely a check-the-box system. And I think it's really complicated. It's a complicated issue, the way that life is complicated. So, you know, when you're dealing with people with complicated layers to them, you can't just check a box because it's not getting at everything. Like Sharon said, you know, people need to understand what is the deeper, why the culture continues, right? So checking a box meets compliance, but it's not going to change the culture. It just isn't going to do it, because we have to be able to talk and feel and think and get people engaged, and they have to understand why the culture continues.
I think it's interesting also that you referred to it as had to sit through training. And
correct.
I think all of us in our experiences with training previously, or maybe it goes back to our schooling, we were required to listen to things and didn't, and therefore perhaps didn't get from them what we could or we should, which is why participatory training is so important.
Cecilia, what kind of training do you work with in regards to your students at the University of Rochester? What do you have right now?
Yes, so we have a really robust training program for our student leaders. These are students that are have been academically successful, particularly in the STEM courses. And they're hired by us and by the various departments to lead collaborative learning for other students. And so they have a lot of responsibilities as student leaders. And we train them in pedagogy, in group facilitation. But what we find is that one of the things that make them really effective leaders is empathy and being able to really read their peers' emotions and needs and kind of go a little bit beyond the simplest explanations for their behavior so that they can really facilitate learning for them. And so I think the idea of establishing more personal connection is a really powerful idea in student leader training, and I believe in every other significant learning.
And I know that's exactly what Impact Interactive does. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Listeners, if you'd like to share your experiences with workplace training, especially sexual harassment training, you can call the program and join this conversation. 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or you can email the program at connections@wxxi.org. You can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. And of course, if you want to call and you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Sharon, let's break down the new law. So how has the law changed? What did things look like before? And now, well, since October, what is required by companies now?
So there are actually a variety of laws. So New York City had actually rushed to enact its law before New York State enacted its law. But New York State's law requires a variety of things, but as it impacts your listeners most, it requires that employers, all employers, whether you have one employee, five employees, or 2,500 employees, that you have what the state deems to be a more effective policy. So the policy, there's a draft policy that was put out by the state. You don't have to adopt that policy, but you have to have a policy that does, that is what they deem to be an effective policy. So it has to define what constitutes sexual harassment. It has to tell you or the employee what to do about it. It has to tell you what the alternatives are. And one innovative piece of the legislation is that it requires that there be a draft complaint given to employees. That requirement was effective October 9th of 2018. So anybody in the listening audience who's an employer who has not adopted the policy, you are behind and need to do it. It also required training. And the training has to be interactive. That means you can't just, you know, sit in front of a screen and read about sexual harassment. It has to be interactive. However, the law does not define what interactive means, which is, I think, what gives so much latitude to employers to make a determination at this juncture to have effective interactive training. That requirement originally was supposed to come into being on October 9th of 2018. There was mass unrest. How can we do it so quickly? And in fact, the state didn't come up with their draft or model training programs until about 2 weeks before. So that requirement has been put on hold until October 9th of 2019. But it's not too early to start training. You have to have trained your employees by October 9th, and then you'll have to train them annually.
So when you talk about the definition of interactive, Allison, I saw you nodding. Could interactive, Sharon, be something as simple to some employers as clicking through a PowerPoint or a video, or does it have to be something that is more physically interactive, more mentally engaging, like what Impact Interactive does? Is there a loophole that
I don't think legally it has to be like what that it has to be that type of training. But legally, it has to be more than clicking through a video. It has to be interactive in terms of some sort of feedback. It could be by webinar with a host of the webinar who can answer questions. But basically, what the state is saying is you can't leave people hanging out there not knowing whether their concepts are correct or not. But again, there's a difference, in my opinion, between being legally compliant and engaging in effective training as a part of an effective anti-discrimination policy at your workplace.
Well, the research shows that interactive training does work, especially drama-based techniques that Impact Interactive does do, among other companies in the region and in the country. And Allison, Ashley, and Rick, I'll have you walk us through now what exactly takes place when a company brings you in, brings you and your performance educators in. What does that look like? What does a session with you look like?
Well, I'll give you an example of maybe sexual harassment, since we're talking about that. So we would meet with the client, obviously, and find out exactly what their concerns are. We would meet compliance, knowing what New York State is requiring from us in a variety of ways, through written material and also through interactive activities and a scripted scene. And we have a bunch of different scripted scenes based on one specifically for the Parks Department, one that's a little more geared towards corporate world. And we would get participants up immediately, so they are immediately engaged in some sort of activity, and we actually do this on purpose to make them uncomfortable. And we make them uncomfortable, which sounds mean, but it's so that we can talk about how people feel and behave when they're uncomfortable, and how when you are uncomfortable, you are interacting with people. Gets you consciously thinking about your own behavior. We give them an opportunity to get into small group discussions by simply asking them, when you think of sexual harassment at work, what comes to mind for you? Because the feedback we get is we never, ever, ever get an opportunity to have a conversation with our coworkers ever about this sort of thing. And so we found that to be really important. And then we do a scripted scene. And during that scene, we may pause and do some teaching points. You know, what is sexual harassment, and breaking that down, because a lot of people think, oh, you know, it's she asked me for a favor and, you know, or he made me sleep with him, or, you know, and it's way more than that, obviously.
Right.
There's harassment, and, you know, so we go through some of that, and then at the end of the scene, the actors stay in character, and this is a really great moment for the participants to be able to ask them questions and dig a little deeper and find out the motivations and the feelings and the thinking behind their behavior, because not every cis male in a scene who is acting like an idiot is a terrible person. There are reasons for people's behavior, right? We're all complex, and that gives people an opportunity to dig a little deeper and find out, what is this guy thinking, or what is this woman thinking, or what's going on for these people? It builds empathy, which Cecilia brought up earlier, which is really crucial for changing the culture and understanding why this keeps happening.
Mm-hmm. It's so important, the concept of using actors, based on what I've read, versus having students or workers just do role-playing, because that character development, that trained actor is able to hit those certain pieces of the mental state of the character. And maybe you're portraying a person, Rick, and I'm sure you've done this, so I'll have you jump on the mic there. You've portrayed someone who may be sexually harassing someone, and in that character's mind, what he's doing is not wrong. And so for you to walk back through that character to justify some of his actions, which of course are unacceptable, but in his mind are, and that's why it's happening, what does that process look like for you? How do you share that with the audience?
I do obviously get cast frequently as a cis male harasser. It's not my favorite thing in the world to do, but it actually is one of the most meaningful things for me to do. The process of getting into the character has actually been, over the last few years, as I've worked with Impact Interactive, been an evolution, right? And being okay with portraying a character who is so, well, frankly, in my opinion, horrible, you know, on some level, has been, I've gotten more and more comfortable with it because it's part of a learning process for everyone in the room. It's at the end of each one of these role plays that we do, where we stay in character for a little bit and answer questions from the participants, we do what's called de-rolling, where each one of us who was in the scene, at least a few of whom were making questionable decisions, is de-rolled, and we say, I was not Joe, I'm Rick, right? And Ashley will say, I was not Claire, I'm Ashley. And we do that really purposefully and specifically, because it's not fun to play that role, because I'm not that guy, though that guy is also part of me, you know? Mm-hmm. I have to admit it.
So. Ashley, how about you? How does that process work for you?
It's always an interesting situation to in our sexual harassment scenes, it's quite common that Rick is the harasser and I'm the harassee, and that's an entirely different mindset to get into, that sort of thought about vulnerability and power structure. And that's one of the things that I very much enjoy about the process, where the audience is able to ask us questions. And it's one of what I think is the great value of this type of training, is that we dig deeper into things like, you know, Sharon mentioned discrimination and respect. There's these additional elements of power structure and the intersectionality of this kind of discrimination. And, you know, how does, for example, a character's race affect their ability to have power in the workplace? What about their managerial position? And there are so many different layers to this. And I really enjoy those coming out in that process as the audience thinks more and more about problem solving. And there's usually the person who puts out a solution that says, well, why don't they just X? And it's often much more complicated than why doesn't someone just X? And the more we learn to look at these bigger pictures where we're understanding the layers that may influence someone's decision, you know, I really think the audience gets so much out of that, and they completely change how they approach problems.
What are some of the questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Did you want to jump in?
I was just going to say that one of the things, two of the things that I've started doing in my training is to use polling apps. We have so much more available to us than we did early on. And the polling apps allow everybody in the audience to vote. And then what I'll do is I'll call upon people to represent each of the sides of the poll. So I'll ask a specific question, and some people will volunteer, and then people will get into talking. And it's absolutely true that the communication is, I think, what causes people to really learn. And it's just a very, very important part about the training.
What are some of the questions in your polls?
So I oftentimes use examples out of my old cases because that's another aspect of it. Like when you say had to sit through through the training, I want people to know that this is real and that I've litigated many, many cases involving claims of sexual harassment. And so I'll ask questions like, does this constitute sexual harassment? Should this be reported to a manager? Is so-and-so just being, quote, too sensitive? Should the manager keep it confidential? These are all issues that come up that are, let me add another piece in there. I'm also a big fan of training managers in their roles in addition to training everybody else, because managers are really the front. They're the people who really see what's going on. They're the people who can really make a difference. And as the EEOC concluded in its 2016 study, you've got to have buy-in from the top. But, you know, so I'll use those kinds of questions, and that will get people thinking, and that will get people started communicating, which is really the end result we all want, because we want people to integrate this and to understand that real people are involved in these situations, both as alleged harassers and as alleged victims. And it does nobody any good. I said I do two things. The other thing that, and I'll just be brief about this, the other thing that I've started doing is to do a piece, particularly when a business is trying to decide about whether to do training and what kind of training. I've done a lot of work in looking at the cost of harassment. And the cost of harassment to a workplace, to a business, is astronomical. Same thing with respect to bullying, which is not as which is not expressly prohibited under the law, but it's a management issue, and it has and people need to know what the ramifications are. It's much easier to make a decision to engage in effective training when you know the cost if you don't.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I was seeing some feedback starting to come in, beginning with the phone. So up first on the phones is Rick in Rochester. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. How are you? Go ahead.
All righty. Our company is also providing training in the sense that we've owned businesses for approximately 20 years in the health sector. And this is a extremely common situation. As I told your speaker, my background, I'm a nurse. So I've been a nurse for 33 years, and I've been the one that's been on the opposite side. Many companies, just last night I was talking to a Rochester fire lieutenant, and they had females in their, within their group now. Well, they all sleep in the same area. And he said, we are so terrified. I said, well, that's what it's come down to, because our societary norms have changed so rapidly and been pushed to the forefront that nobody has time to respond. And they're terrified to respond. So by soothing people's fears, showing them that, yes, you can work with opposite sex or the same sex with people who have desires for the same sex, it can work. But as your guests have pointed out, if the managers aren't in, this is not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Thank
because
you.
Unfortunately, sometimes the managers are the issue.
Right, the top-down approach that Sharon was mentioning. Thank you, Rick. You raised a really important point that I want to talk about. Pew Research is reporting that in a survey of more than 8,000 Americans, 55% of women and, oh, I'm sorry, 55% of men and 47% of women said developments in the Me Too movement have made it more difficult for men to navigate workplace interactions, with some men reporting that they no longer know how to talk to women at work, or they're afraid of being falsely accused of sexual harassment, and then some of them saying that they try to avoid women at work at all costs so they're not falsely accused of something, which reflects some of what you were talking about, Rick. Are you seeing that, Sharon, in your trainings? And I'll open that up to everyone. What are you hearing from men?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that is a real downside of the Me Too movement, is that the Me Too movement, in my opinion, occurred because for a long period of time, women did not have a voice. Now, one of the offshoots of the Me Too movement is that men accused of harassment do not have a voice. And nobody should not have a voice in the workplace. And that's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about the way to change culture is by permitting people to have a voice. I think it's an awful situation for people of one gender to not know whether, to not know how to act. And so that's some of what we do with the training is to provide parameters, what's permissible and what isn't permissible, but not just in terms of legal compliance, in terms of understanding who your audience is, understanding how people feel about things, understanding that workplaces are composed of people who are brash, people who are bullying, and people who are overly sensitive. But we have to find ways to navigate it.
Well, and the concept of people not having a voice in the workplace made me immediately think about a training that we did with the New York City Park Service, which had been rocked by sexual harassment scandal in the past few years. And, you know, speaking to your earlier point, too, Sharon, about managers and getting the top-down buy-in, one of the very first things that we went into in setting up this pilot training with them, they initially wanted us to train just the people at the bottom who were often subject to harassment. And we pushed very hard to make sure that managers were being trained as well. Because without their buy-in, there's no way to change a culture. And it was very interesting going into these trainings where it was comprised mostly of lower-level workers. And one of their very first complaints as we opened was, why do we have to do this and the managers don't? And we told them, the managers are doing this. They were in the training just before you. And it was amazing how the floodgates opened and then they were willing
actually,
to talk.
If I was doing it, I would train the managers first, but I would also have them in the
They did.
Other
yeah,
training.
Their immediate supervisors were in there, but they're talking about just the more white-collar workers were in a separate training, and then for the people who were the actual parks workers, their immediate supervisors were in the training with them, and it did give them the opportunity to talk about some of their complaints and concerns, and it was really illuminating for the managers themselves who were saying, you know, a lot of them didn't even know the extent of their employees' feelings, and they had a different perspective on what it was that these people were facing that they were unaware of because they just weren't on the ground in quite the same way.
Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I just wanted to, the number, the 55%, I think you said, Megan, of
yes.
men who, and the way that it was phrased was that they are unaware of how they should act or they feel uninformed or kind of at sea when it comes to knowing how they are allowed to act. And of course, the solution to the partial solution to that is communication. It is interactive training. So they aren't saying that 55% of men, you know, think that it's all horrible, this entire Me Too movie. No,
right.
It's just 55% are concerned about not knowing how to act. And that's exactly what true interactive training can do. I mean, like what Impact does, like what Sharon does, where it's not just, you know, checkboxes,
etcha,
as we said.
Where it's not just etcha.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
And, conversations.
And yes, actual conversations. And one of the things that strikes me about that is, you know, we've seen an uptick in the number of reports. That may very well have been a positive side effect of not fully effectual training, right? It could be that that uptick is, in fact, from people now knowing, okay, factually what they can do when they are harassed, as opposed to changing the culture, which is what true, you know, the stuff that New York State wants us to now do, training is.
I want to talk a lot more about empathy, about putting people in stressful situations to try to understand these circumstances. I want to talk about if we can expect to see any meaningful change from the law. So we'll turn to our guest about that. But I'm late for our only break, and I see News Director Randy Gorbman waiting patiently for me. So short break, more connections next. Coming up in our second hour, it's the year in television. 2018 was a big year for TV, both on broadcast and on streaming services. Critics say it was off to a slow start, but if you take a look at some of the lists online, lists of best shows, best new shows, they're pretty long. So which shows made your list? And how do you watch your shows? On streaming services, on networks? We talk TV next. You are listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about sexual harassment policies and training based on a new New York State law, which in October, it was mandated that all employers must provide mandatory sexual harassment policies and training. My guests for the hour are Sharon Stiller, a partner and director of the employment law practice at Abrams & Fensterman, Allison Roberts, co-founder and co-director of Impact Interactive, a theater-based training company, Rick Starpoli, a performance educator with Impact Interactive, Ashley Valdez-Garcelle, a business manager and performance educator for Impact Interactive, and Cecilia Barone. She's the assistant director in the workshop program at the University of Rochester's Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning. I'm seeing a lot of your questions come in. We will get to those in just one moment, but first, a quick message from News Director Randy Gordman.
And we'll try and make this brief, Megan, but a very important message. A great topic, one of many here on Connection throughout the year, with, of course, Megan and with Evan Dawson. And today's issue, one that affects a lot of people who are in the working world and even those outside of it as well, but a really expert, interesting panel. But again, to continue this kind of programming, we need your help. This is our one-day fundraising drive to close out the year and kind of put a good cap on 2018. You can make a pledge right now at 454-6300, 454-6300, or toll-free 1-800-295-9994. 1-800-295-9994, or you can do it online, a safe, secure way to do that at wxxinews.org. Whatever you can do, it is appreciated. And don't forget, of course, any contribution made to WXXI as we end the year very soon is tax deductible. Megan?
Thank you, Randy. If you're waiting on the phone, give us just 1 minute. We'll be right with you. First, a question from a listener via email. He says, can we expect to see any meaningful change from the law when your guests have already said that the culture has to change? In other words, this really is not about the law, is it?
I think it's both. I think the law matters, but I think that, that it's both. I mean, we have to enforce it. The question I have for Sharon is that's tricky.
So I see the law as being a vehicle for businesses to make the decision. Yep. To do effective training. But if they only check the box, then I don't think we will see any changes. We haven't seen any before from simply compliance training. And so there's some old saying, I'm terrible in old sayings, but if you keep doing the same thing that you've been doing before. But it has the potential to be a call for change.
Absolutely.
A second question from this listener. What's a reasonable expectation for the amount of sexual harassment at work? Can we get it to zero? Is that too idealistic? Or can we actually eliminate all sexual harassment at work?
I don't see why not. I mean, sexual harassment is not just sexual. It's not that you have to eliminate all banter or all fun or all anything. You have to eliminate things that make other people uncomfortable based on a protected category. And people are going to say, you know, Sharon, you've been in practice for 1,000 years and you do this all the time. You've written the book on it for New York. You really sound like a Pollyanna, but I don't see any reason for it in the workplace to begin with. So I don't see any reason why it can't be eliminated.
I would agree. My immediate thought went to what Allison was talking about and what Sharon's been talking about in a workplace who sees the law change as a call to action to make a culture change. Those are the sort of workplaces where I think we could expect sexual harassment to be non-existent, because that's a company committed to a major cultural shift. And if they are willing to put their best foot forward and really work with their employees on creating that safe environment, I think they'll reap dividends in productivity. I mean, it's just, you said yourself earlier, Sharon, about just the cost of harassment. Never mind the terrible emotional burden of sexual harassment in the workplace, but there is a workplace cost. I mean, there's absenteeism that goes with people being afraid to walk in the door at work. And those
loss
are
of
things.
Productivity.
Absolutely. Those are things that we can reasonably expect to eliminate in a workplace that is aware of the problems and willing to make solutions.
Here's Phil on Twitter. He says, you get the culture you model. As a training manager for over 20 years, I can tell you that management behavior and enforcement matters more than the mode of training.
I think that's true. And that goes back to something we were talking about over the break, which was The EEOC's recommendation to change training was only part of a number of recommendations. One of what I believe to be the most significant recommendations is that instead of just addressing training or just addressing policies, that a workplace begin an It's On Us campaign to let each of the workers know that everybody is responsible for the environment. It's not just managers, it's not just employees, it's not just the leaders. Everybody has to model it, and everybody has to want to have a workplace where everybody likes to come to work.
Mm-hmm. Cecilia, what have you heard from your students regarding workplace culture, classroom culture, and how it's changed throughout the era of Me Too?
This is a little bit outside of my area of expertise here. So I feel like, you know, I can speak personally just for from my experience that certainly that has impacted me as a staff member at the University of Rochester. Although I was not involved in the specifics of how U of R is dealing with it, I think as a whole, we are as a community trying to just improve the sense of responsibility and the number of initiatives that deal with inclusivity in general, more broadly speaking. So I can certainly speak to that. And so I think particularly when we work with students who have roles of responsibilities towards other students, it's really important for us to be able to give them tools that they can use independent on the trainers when they find themselves in situations that are challenging. And for me, given my area of expertise, this means challenging group dynamics in collaborative learning. And so I think the students have recognized the importance of thinking about checking their own assumptions and as they find themselves in these challenging situations before taking action. And in that respect, I found the training that Impact Interactive has provided in collaboration with us for the past 3 years really effective, because this is the training that they provide. I see it almost like a group facilitation lab where student leaders can kind of rehearse and try to problem solve collaboratively, working with professional actors in a low stakes situations, right? So that when they find themselves in those scenarios, they have had the opportunity to think a little bit more about their assumptions and how their action can affect the environment. And so in that sense, I think that I see something positive coming our way, and the seeds of change have been planted. But again, I cannot comment on the specifics of sexual harassment.
Well, you bring up important tools. And I think another thing we talked about during the break was bystander intervention training, which is so important. So let's break that down a little bit and what the EEOC says about bystander intervention training. Let's start with that, Sharon, what they said in that report.
So it's really part of the It's On Us campaign, because I can probably make it more understandable by going back to a pledge that the Urban League had years ago, which was, not only will I not discriminate, but I will not allow discrimination to occur in my presence, which at that time I thought was powerful, and I still believe that it's incredibly powerful. So bystander training provides training to other employees on how they can deal with situations in which they are viewing or hearing discrimination occurring, something that's inappropriate, how they can take appropriate action. The EEOC also recommended that there be civility training. I'm not sure that I'm willing to go that far, and I always worry about there being us giving permission to people to be vigilantes in the workplace. That's not what anybody wants. But the concept that we get the workplace that we create and we're all part of it, it's a puzzle with each of us being a piece of the puzzle, is very, very important. And you have to give everybody tools. You have to give managers tools So the bystander training also gives bystanders tools on how to deal with that situation instead of turning a blind eye.
Mm-hmm. Ashley. Oh, you looked like you wanted to jump in there.
I always look like I want. This is just my face, Megan.
You're eager. I like it. Here's a question, another question from a listener. He says, I have heard technology. Stand by. I have heard men conclude that with the recent changes, it is no longer appropriate to ever flirt at work. Is that true? Rick is the only man in the room.
I love it. I'll always be the male representative. I don't know whether legally that is too broad of a statement, but it certainly always seems inappropriate to me. How about that? I actually don't know whether the law would be very, very clear on that.
So it's a great question. Part of the issue and part of the reasons why we continue to see people not knowing what to do is there are gray areas. Mm-hmm. So flirting is different than flirting. And I think it really depends on what people do. I mean, there's still going to be situations where people ask out other people in the workplace because you spend most of your time there, and that's a fertile field for finding dates. But flirting in a way that makes somebody feel uncomfortable can, if it is sufficiently pervasive, constitute sexual harassment. So when people ask me those kinds of questions during training, the answer is, if you want to be very sure you're not offending anybody, don't do it. But there are some parameters. It has to be offensive and it has to be pervasive sexual conduct in order to constitute sexual harassment.
And in terms of a workplace change, I feel like that's such an interesting question because it is a gray area. Allison was talking earlier about when we start a program that we have an exercise that's intended to make people uncomfortable because there is so much value in understanding the many different ways that people react to being uncomfortable and why someone may not speak up. So it's a very difficult situation, for example, to be somebody flirting with a coworker, not recognizing subtle signs of their discomfort, and then coming to the conclusion that, well, because they didn't say no to this, this is welcome behavior. And that's part of getting into those deeper layers of understanding of, you know, how could somebody, if somebody is laughing nervously, well, is she laughing at my joke or is she laughing because I'm making her really uncomfortable?
That's one of the old cases. I think it was Virginia Tech, something like that. It was one of the military schools where a group of men actually handcuffed a woman to a new probationary person, somebody who just started there, woman, to a pipe, and she was laughing, and the defense was she was laughing. Well, you know, again, just like there are many types of flirting, there are many types of laughing.
With the gray area, this is a hypothetical situation. Say I'm working in an office, and I'm uncomfortable with something that someone is saying or doing related to me, and I'm not sure if it's sexual harassment or not, but I'm afraid to go to HR because I'm afraid of retaliation. How do you talk with someone who has those concerns, who is like right on the edge? I'm not quite sure. I'm really uncomfortable. I don't want to go to work because this is happening, but I have to go to work. So what would you tell someone like that?
Okay, I hear great
they're
silence.
All thinking, so. They're all thinking.
So,
yeah.
So I'm going to jump in again. Yeah. But you know, the bottom line, I don't think it has to rise to the level of sexual harassment in order for somebody to complain about something that makes them feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it would be a shame that they feel like they can't speak to HR, which theoretically should have one foot with the employees as well as one foot in with management. But the bottom line is that things are not going to change unless people know what's happening. So, but it's the person's decision about whether they're going to complain or not. I think what I would do is I would provide information to them about the options that exist, which is exactly what the new policy requirements are designed to do. And then help them feel safe and secure in trying to make the workplace a better place.
I think, too, it goes along with it. So if a person is sexually assaulted, you know, the last thing you want to do is say, here's what you got to go do, mm-hmm. right? You want to give them options so that they still are in power, right? They've just gone through something where they've lost all their power. And so you want to give them options and support and be an ally, and then ultimately the decision is theirs. And I think with sexual harassment, you want to give them options and support. Ultimately, it is up to them, but encourage support.
You know, it's such a difficult issue because what you hear most in these situations is the alleged victim saying, I just want it to go away, mm-hmm. just want it to stop.
Right, and that's part of the importance of, we were talking about bystander intervention, and, right. and when you had asked that question, Megan, the first thing I thought was, what are all the factors involved in this particular scenario? Because I think to say, as a blanket statement, this is what I would do in a given situation without knowing everything going on is really
right.
tough. And Allison makes an excellent point about sexual harassment is something that robs the person being harassed of agency. And that's a big thing that we have to keep in mind about not further robbing them of agency. You know, my first thought is that it's a manager issue we talk about, right? It's ideally you would have a supportive manager who can assist this person in stopping behavior. But as a bystander, I'm assuming in the scenario that I'm a coworker, you know, the very first thing to do is how much can we help protect our coworkers and create a culture where the behavior, maybe not, if it's a behavior that doesn't rise to sexual harassment that needs to be taken to the HR, or it's the decision of the person being harassed that they don't want to do so, how do we, as the people around that person, protect them and create a culture that does not allow for that behavior to take place?
Right. Well, and one of the bigger issues for management is when somebody comes to them and says, this is what's happening, but I want you to keep it confidential. Mm-hmm. The manager cannot keep it confidential at that juncture. It's a very delicate psychological issue, but they can't. And the bottom line is, again, I don't think that you can create a better culture unless you know what the culture is to begin with.
Absolutely. And that's the value of some of these trainings that we're talking about. We open the floor for discussion. And opening the floor for discussion is step one towards creating a change in a culture.
Mm-hmm. Sharon, what are the penalties for employers if they don't comply with this new law?
Actually, there are no specific penalties so far. However, the way that I think it will come out is I think that when there is the law is a combined effort of the Labor Department and the New York State Division of Human Rights. So I think what will wind up happening is that when there is a claim that is made to the New York State Division of Human Rights, there will be an additional claim of discrimination as a result of not having a compliant policy or compliant training. And that will make it more difficult for employers to fight the initial claim of discrimination. So again, warning, be compliant.
Listen to the attorney. Yeah. If you have not done this training yet, you have until October 9th, 2019. Stay in compliance with that training. We're down to our last couple minutes, and here's an email from Ray Ray. He says, harassment is a social issue. Sexual harassment, racial harassment, all forms of oppression are social issues. Everyone needs to become fluent in how to engage with them with accountability and where they have tendencies to impact others and humility and going about their varying privileges. This is creative, physical, participatory work, not for PowerPoints and click-through quizzes. Workers need to not just know what to say out of fear of losing their jobs, but how to act to disrupt these oppressive environments and perpetuate the culture. It's social work that comes from bottom-up interactions with everyone involved, but also top-down interactions, as we've talked about
it's
throughout
on
the
us.
Hour.
It's on it's us on, is what Ray us. Ray is saying.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ray Ray. Thanks for that. I'd like to end the hour by just going around the panel and asking each of our guests what they'd like to see. They are all involved in different types of interactive training, but what, in your experience, has worked the best, whether it was just a situation or a specific example or a tactic that you use or have been part of, what has worked the best in case there are companies listening, employers listening, who are looking to try this type of work? Rick?
Yeah, the amount that I have learned about myself, my own behaviors, you know, in social settings, in work settings, et cetera, just from conversations, it's been kind of staggering. So I don't care what form the training takes place, really, as long as it is well monitored, you know, by a person who is caring and understands the issues and is creating a positive environment. So the exact form doesn't matter as much as it has to be a true conversation. There have to be actually opportunities for those sitting in, you know, the participants to speak and to hear.
Ashley.
And to piggyback off of Rick, because I agree completely, some of the best work that I've seen is just around having discussions. And I feel like a really powerful thing that we have done in a training previously is as people are in groups and sharing out things that they've talked about, we've written them down and sort of reviewed it back at the end. And that was really powerful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Allison.
Companies really need to invest. This is not a one and done. You have to invest in your people and you have to have conversations that are uncomfortable and difficult. Mm. Got to do it.
Cecilia. Yeah, and I think the conversation starts with telling stories about people in context, which I think is a powerful thing that the theater-based training does, and I'm really proud that we're doing this together.
Humanizing the issues.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sharon.
And I think having a commitment to take advantage of the tools that are not being that are now being required and to make a decision about what's needed in your workplace along with everybody else there is important.
Well, we will certainly continue these conversations in 2019. We'll have links to important information on the podcast page for this episode. I'd like to thank all of my guests, Sharon Stiller, Allison Roberts, Rick Starpoli, Ashley Valdez-Garcelle, and Cecilia Barone. Thank you all. Thank you all for listening.
Thank
More
you.
Connections next.